ceded Coast Salish territory of the Halkomelem speaking Musqueam people.
Hempology 101 is a student-run organization here to educate the public about the benefits of hemp and cannabis. Fast fact! Hemp is a renewable, sustainable source of food and fiber. Fast fact! Your body contains anandamide, which is part of the same family of substances as THC. To learn more, look us up on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/hempology101UBC. Or come to one of our great events. And don't forget, legalization through education.
Too right. Hello, hello, hello. You're listening to the CITR 101.9 FM from unceded Musqueam territory at UBC Vancouver. My name is Simon Welton. And coming up in the next half hour is, as always, the White Noise Show. That's a half hour of sketch comedy followed, as it always is, by the White Noise After Show. This week, hosted by myself and featuring special guest Connor Neckelpert.
I've been demoted from special guest, special friend, special guest, have I?
We go back and forth, you know, it just depends how I'm feeling this
week. I would like the listeners to know that Simon is wearing a very sexy blue shirt this evening.
It's a Kaiser Chiefs shirt. It's my favourite shirt. It's a bit tight, yeah. But it's a good shirt.
It's a great shirt.
I'm holding out.
What animal do you think that is on it?
It's like a panther.
Panther? Like a leopard?
I think it's a panther.
Or like a lantha?
Yeah, no one else cares, so let's not worry about it. So, as I said, the White Noise Show is about to start, and we'll be then joined in the studio by Connor Neckelpert. I know you're all excited. I know you're all excited for the White Noise After Show, which is where we debate and sort of pull apart some of the issues that we raise in the sketches we do. And we also do a bit of current events discussion. And you can get involved. Just send in your questions or raise topics or your opinions and we'll discuss them. And you send them in to whitenoiseubc@gmail.com. You can also keep up with us throughout the week at whitenoiseubc on Facebook and on Twitter. And you can, of course, check out the best of White Noise all the week at whitenoisecomedy.podbean.com. But without further ado, it's time for some White Noise.
Warning, the following programming contains adult subject matter and some strong language. It is a work of satirical fiction. All characters and advertisements are completely fabricated. Listener discretion is advised.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of White Noise. I'm your host, Richard Blackmore, and tonight's episode is brought to you in part by Slam Poetry. It's rap music for white people. First up tonight, Carl and Neil are back.
Carl?
Yes, Mum?
Come change the sheets. Me and Neil are finished.
Oh, Mum, please no. It's bad enough you're shagging my best friend.
Well, until one of you starts paying rent, that's the deal.
Cheer up, Carl. I've got a plan.
Oh, yeah? What's that then?
We're going to rob the corner shop down the road.
Oh, that's a good idea, as we also need some milk.
Carl, over here.
Hey.
Did you get the balaclavas?
Nah, they only had baklavas.
At the ski shop?
Yeah.
Well, did you bring the guns?
Nah, they only had buns.
Carl, did you go to a bakery?
No, I couldn't find the shop, so I nicked some guy's lunch. You want a Kit Kat?
No! Actually, yeah, go on then. Put your hands in the air!
Hang on, Neil. I'm just finishing my crossword.
How do you know it's me?
Those underpants hardly obscure your face.
Well, we've got guns, so to do as we say.
Carl, you're both clearly just painted your fingers black.
Do as we say, or I'm gonna hit you with my shoe.
I'm not scared of a flip-flop. Now piss off.
Hit him, Neil.
Yeah, take this.
Oh, you bastard, that really hurt.
I told you to clear off.
All right, we're going. Come on, Carl. and thanks for nothing, Dad.
Yeah, yeah. I'll see you at Sunday dinner. Why is my son such a wanker?
Don't rob your parents. Rob your grandparents. They're much slower. Next up tonight, Elvis and Bono are back.
Good evening, Elvis and Bono. We have a new mission ready for you. We need you to fix Syria.
Huh?
The whole thing?
Yes. The buck has been passed over and over, so now it's your responsibility.
Damn.
So, how do we fix it?
I don't know. That's part of the problem. Nobody has a clue.
I got it. How about some homemade C4?
No, we've tried that. A lot. Maybe a free concert in Damascus?
No, that won't work. Even though it did work for AIDS.
What about diplomacy?
You think a 2-year college course is gonna solve this?
Diplomacy, not a diploma.
Still sounds like nerdy stuff, man.
Come on, guys. You must have one good idea.
I got it, man. One sec. Okay, it's ringing. Hi, is that Russia? Yeah, man. This is America. How you doing? Yeah, you can have Syria. Well, what's left of it. And no takebacks. There, sorted. What?
Donald Trump wants to blow up Syria. I want to smack him in the mouth. We can't have everything we want. Next up tonight, Kanye West is dead.
For the day I die, I'ma touch the sky. Gotta testify.
Good afternoon, Kanye. Welcome to heaven.
Oh, wow. Hey, God. So, I made it. And the haters said I wouldn't.
Well, there is nothing in the Bible about being a douche, though there probably should be.
I knew one day I would return to the kingdom of heaven to sit upon my rightful throne.
That's actually what I came to talk to you about. You see, you gotta cool it with the Son of God stuff. No one here knows about what happened with me and your mum.
What?
Well, she said she was on the pill. I mean, I was pretty hammered, so I took the risk, but my wife cannot find out about this.
So, I really am the Son of God?
Yes, and a bastard, so everyone was half right.
So you're saying I can't tell anyone?
No, I mean, you could still tweet about it. I mean, everyone important here is too old to notice. Just don't write a book about it, sing about it, or tattoo it anywhere.
Can I Instagram it?
Yeah, just don't telegram it, all right?
Oh, okay. So, can I come visit you sometime, Dad?
Well, maybe next week. This weekend is my Axis Day with Jesus, so we're going paintballing.
Can I come too?
Not this time. I'm still rebuilding my relationship with Jesus. He still hasn't forgiven me for the whole crucifixion thing. I mean, talk about a bad day to oversleep.
Unlucky Kanye. I only get to visit my dad once a year, too. His prison is very difficult to get to. Not a lot of direct flights to Guantanamo Bay. Next up tonight, someone is buying booze.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Larry's Liquor, home of the drunken cat.
You have a drunk cat?
Yes, my wife Catherine, lying on the floor over there.
Piss off, Mike.
What can I get you?
I was wondering if you could recommend me something.
Anything in particular?
What do 14-year-old girls like to drink?
Sorry?
14-year-old girls, what do they drink?
Pop? Or juice, maybe?
But if you were buying something in here?
Then coolers, I guess?
Great. I'll take 4 cases of Smirnoff Ice, please.
Can I ask, what are they for?
I'm having a party.
Oh, well, in that case, gonna have to say something.
Oh? What?
You should really buy some Doritos, too.
Oh, okay, yeah. What flavor do 14-year-old girls like?
That was creepier than my granddad's toenails. His nails are so creepy, I keep them in a box by my bed to scare off burglars. Next up tonight, someone is in turmoil.
Dad, I have something to tell you.
Oh, okay, son, what is it?
Dad, I think I'm stupid.
Oh, it's okay. I've known for ages.
You have?
Yeah, ever since you were a little kid. You've always been different from the others. They liked playing football. You liked eating grass. A lot of them liked playing with toy cars. You tried to play with regular cars and got run over a lot.
Oh, wow. So everyone knew except me?
Your mum was in denial. She kept buying you lab coats and expensive calculators, and she even sent you to that Scared Smart course. None of it worked.
Are you ashamed of me?
No, of course not. Can't help the way you were born.
Is this where mum left?
Well, after your older brother electrocuted himself by putting his tongue in the wall socket, it just all got a bit too much for her.
I wasn't a clever child, but neither were my parents, so they didn't really notice. Next up tonight, there's trouble in paradise.
Darling?
Yes, Ian?
Have you been trying to pee standing up again?
So what if I have? Women can do anything a man can.
Yes, except that.
What are you talking about? It's just a matter of practice like anything else. You've been practicing since you were born. I just have some catching up to do.
Well, in the meantime, our bathroom looks like R. Kelly's bedroom.
What?
Look, can you not just sit down?
Fine, if you'll stop using my tampons.
Wait, how is that fair? Fine, but I'm still gonna use the panty liners.
Not sure what he would do with those, but then again, I'm not really sure what women do with them either. Next up tonight, someone is browsing.
Afternoon, welcome to Lush. How can I help you?
How much is that fudge in the window?
Fudge?
That stuff there.
That's soap, darling. This is a cosmetic store.
Oh. Well, never mind then.
Oh, don't dismay, sir. There's plenty I can offer you here.
Really? But I'm a guy.
Yes, but you're also quite ugly. There's a lot we can do for that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Everything from a scrub for those pores, something for the smell, a moisturizer for the dry skin, and a nice decorative bag for the whole head.
And how much is that all going to cost?
You can't put a price on not being alone.
Tell that to the escort service I owe a small fortune to.
Oh, come on. Won't this be a bit better?
I really just wanted some fudge.
Tell you what, I'll throw in a Purdy's gift card.
Done.
I don't buy soap from Lush because I don't buy soap. I just squeeze a bit in my hand in the public washrooms and then I run home very quickly to shower. Next up tonight, two lions are chatting.
Ah, it's bloomin' hot today.
It's always hot. It's Africa.
I'm really worried, mate. Especially after what happened to Bill.
Calm down. You know that was all blown out of proportion.
How do we know that there aren't more dentists out there waiting to shoot us?
Oh, come on. You know as well as I do, Billy was asking for it.
How can you say that?
Please. Oh, yeah, he was a saint, according to everyone, once he died. But that guy was a right dickhead when he was alive.
You can't say that.
Why? Because he's dead? That guy used to give me wet willies.
He'd stick his paw in your ear?
No, he'd slap me with his wet cock.
But that doesn't mean he deserves to get shot.
Quiet. Here comes that religious monkey nutter, Rafiki.
I think he's a baboon.
Hello, boys.
All right,
Hi. Why aren't you out hunting with the other lions?
Cramp. Got a witch doctor's note.
Well, stay hydrated. It's hot today.
Yeah, we noticed. Thanks. Oh, good, he's gone. Why doesn't he cover up that arse? Looks like a Kardashian.
Never mind that. What about the dentists?
Relax. Ricky Gervais is gonna save us. He's been tweeting about it. Now, let's go eat. I saw some hyenas working on a carcass over the ridge. We can nick their lunch money.
I agree with Ricky. Dentists are the real predators. Now, a short excerpt from the dramatic adaptation of the timeless children's classic, Charlie and the Asbestos Factory.
You did it, Charlie. You won.
Won? Won what?
Everything. You won everything, you silly pleb.
I don't understand.
This weird, endless tour has all been a ruse.
But why?
Because I'm gay.
What?
And also live in Victorian England, so I need an heir.
I wondered what that was with the purple jacket.
Yeah, and I wondered what the smell was with you, but Charlie explained you've been living in your own filth for years.
But why me?
Isn't that obvious, Charlie? You were the sexiest kid here.
What?
And you didn't try to fuck me over with the creepy asbestos rival who I hired to bribe you. And necessity is the mother of all innovation. Someone as poor as you will have a million new ideas for asbestos. Soon, asbestos will be in everything!
Gee, thanks!
However, Charlie, the truth is, the asbestos business has been stagnating. Especially after all my staff went orange and they shrank a bit.
Well, what can we do to fix this?
Hire children. Then maybe no one will notice.
Sounds good to me.
And we might be able to move your family in.
Oh, wow. Do you think that it'll cure Grandma Al and Grandma Ivy's depression?
No, probably not. Now, if you'll just step into the elevator, and we'll be on our way. Oh, shit. This elevator's full of asbestos.
I once lived in a house with asbestos in the ceiling. Actually, I still do. I should probably move, but living at Mum's house is quite cheap. Last up tonight, I bring you an extract from the film adaptation of my childhood. This is Blackmore, Beards, B.O. and Backney.
Come in. Hello, Richard.
Morning, Dave.
Pardon?
I mean, good morning, Headmaster.
Please, take a seat. I presume you know why you're here.
If it's about the school hamster, it's always had three legs.
No. Wait, what did you do to the hamster? Never mind. No. This is about you being caught peeping in the girls' changing room.
What? No, I wasn't.
You were caught red-handed by Mr. Alderman.
What was he doing in the girls' changing room?
That's a fantastic point, but that's not the issue at hand. It's time you grew up. You're 11 years old. You can't continue with this reckless behaviour. Do you want to end up working in radio?
Oh, that would be awesome. I could be the next Jimmy Savile.
That's what I'm trying to prevent. You need to sort yourself out before you come to school. It will stop you getting distracted.
Oh, all right, yeah, no problems.
And have a shave. Preteens shouldn't look like ZZ Top.
Who?
You look like a garden gnome. Sort it out.
Yes, I haven't changed much since I was 11. Except I'm a little taller. Less like a garden gnome now. More like a dwarf. That's the end of our show. Join us again for more White Noise.
White Noise was written and directed by Simon Welton, starring the voice talents of Connor Neckleput and Simon Welton.
Guest writing by Connor Neckleput. All right, there you go. That was the White Noise sketch show. I hope you enjoyed that.
Was that really a sketch show? I didn't know what to make of it.
Well, I think that is the epitome of sketch, where there is no cohesive idea to anything.
It's literally not an iota of sense.
They all just are their own thing, doing their own thing for their you know, they're just enjoyable in their short life.
The weird thing is, all the characters sounded the same.
Sounded like there were two people doing the whole thing this week, yeah. Thanks.
Which is interesting, because this is the first sign that we've done episode just between you and I.
Is it?
I don't think we've done one before. Like, yeah, that. We've always had someone else.
We tried to get other people in, but because we actually have five other contributors who are all girls, and all of them were busy this week.
Yeah,
one's out of province, fair dues, and the others had work and other commitments. So
one's out of the country, isn't she?
Which one?
Caitlin?
No, she's, I think it was work or something.
Oh, okay,
or maybe she's away. Maybe she's away. Maybe I'm, that's not fair. If she's, I mean,
I feel like that's a
either way,
now.
She's not here. Yeah. That's the main part. So it was all being coded this week. So you heard our range of female voices that we employed. We don't actually think women sound like that. Please don't take offense from some of the voices we used. It's just,
if you do, it's your fault, because representations are by nature simplifications.
Right, yeah, and just, you know, take it in your stride. You don't sound that terrible. It's just radio. It's okay. And quite frankly, I think no one actually likes the sound of their own voice. Anyway.
No, I hate mine. Yeah,
yeah. If you listen to yourself back, you say, I sound ridiculous. Yeah. But
I you made a good point in the last sketch. I mean, radio, just don't pay much attention to it. It's just not good.
Well, I think with the Jimmy Savile thing, it was that we should have paid more attention there. That was the problem. If you don't know about Jimmy Savile, you could look him up, but it won't make your night any better, so I wouldn't bother.
You'll probably feel like a worse person for it, to be honest.
No, you're just thinking he's a lot worse than your neutral stance on not knowing who he is. You know, it's like looking up who Hitler is for the first time. Like, oh,
it's just sort of depressing.
Darn. Okay, we're going to play some tracks, and then we're going to come back and do the White Noise after show, as we always do. So, I was about to say, we're very excited about this first track. Maybe Connor isn't going to
This first track is actually, I was making a poor taste remark on the after show. So this track is actually bombastic.
Okay, so the track's going to be good, and then Connor's deciding to say don't come back. But please, you should come back, because we're going to have a bit of chit-chat, and we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of some of the stuff we talked about tonight on the show, and we're going to play loads of kick-ass music. So
starting off with?
We're going to start off with Ariel Sharratt and Matthias Kom, and this track is called Fuck the Government, I Love You.
Met at the New Year's party of my vegetarian friend.
I said I was studying English.
I told you I was in a band.
I asked what the band was called.
I said it's called The Burning Hell.
I said I've never heard of you.
I said that's probably just as well. Just to make conversation, I told you about a dream I had in which Jean Baudrillard was rapping with Public Enemy, shouting, don't believe the hype are real, with Flava Flav and Chuck D.
And I said I think we might have a lot in common then, possibly, because I'm also a musician, and also a student of hip-hoposophy.
You mentioned you used to play the clarinet in high school in the early years of the millennium when you were young.
And you said you're hired, the pay is negligible, and the tour starts next month.
You asked what I was working on. I said I'm writing an album of love songs.
I laughed and said love songs are dumb.
And I said, oh yeah, wait till you hear these ones.
Pass the wine, fuck the government, I love you. Three statements overheard at once in the crowded room. But I could not be sure which one had come from you.
So I passed you the wine and said, yes, fuck the government, I love you too.
Dancers, we danced a little bit.
My vegetarian friend was playing the hits of Will Smith, then we got jiggy with it there on the dance floor.
The living room dance floor,
that's when it happened. You stole my heart.
I stole a kiss.
We stole someone else's gin by accident. At some point we got cornered by an amateur poet neither of us knew.
Either had no one else to talk to or couldn't pick up simple social cues.
Step by step we backed away until we backed up all the way into the bathroom together.
We told the poet that we always go together, 'cause that's what happens when you've been dating forever. We stayed in there for ages hoping the amateur poet would go as awkward. We came out and found he discovered someone else to bother. And suddenly it was midnight and old like sign time and countdowns and gratuitous public making out. And we started shouting 'cause everyone else was shouting. And isn't it fun to shout? Pass the wine, fuck the government, I love you. Three statements overheard at once in the crowded room. But I could not be sure which one had come from you. So I passed you the wine and said, yes, fuck the government, I love you too. Pass the wine, fuck the government, I love you. Three statements overheard at once in the crowded room. But I could not be sure which one had come from you. So I passed you the wine and said, yes, fuck the government, I love you too.
Thank you. Imagine living in a place that feels like nowhere you've ever been, but immediately feels like home. A place where you can grow the career you want and earn more than you've ever dreamed. Where a modern life meets an endless outdoor playground just outside your back door. Imagine big skies, big playgrounds, and big opportunities. Imagine the Northwest Territories. Learn more at comemakeyourmark.ca.
That was the Radiation Flowers with 17 off their self-titled The Radiation Flowers. And before that was Jessica O'Neill with Stella off Cheekbone. All right, you're listening to the White Noise After Show. My name is Simon Welton, and I'm joined in the studio by special guest Connor Neckleput. And our first topic for discussion today, sir, is we had the sketch about Charlie and the Asbestos Factory.
That's a classic.
It was. That was. I enjoyed that. I felt like that was a good collaboration by us.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
You know, we. Yeah, that was good because Connor wrote it out, and then I did some editing, and that was what we ended up with.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was nicely
so
done. So
is the end of that sketch? Do they all just die in the elevator? Is that what happens?
No, they die over like 10 years with a lot of coughing, and then you know it's just asbestos isn't like an instant death. It's a slow burn.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering in concentrations like that in an elevator. I wonder if it is just asphyxiation almost.
I guess maybe. I don't know. Let's not dwell
on
it.
We didn't really reveal the quantity of
asbestos. It's a sketch show. It's a sketch show. We're not worrying about the death ratio in it, really.
We should have. There's a lot of death in our sketches. It's actually a bit depressing.
Well, when Elvis gets his homemade C4 out, it happens. It's not my fault. All right. So,
no, never.
So connected to that, let's actually get to the question. If you could be living in any children's book, which one would it be?
Have to go for see, to me it's a bit of a tie between Harry Potter and the Chronicles of Narnia.
Really?
I'm not particularly religious, so the religious aspects of the Chronicles of Narnia and that whole series are kind of lost to me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I still love the idea of being in a land with all these sort of fantastic sort of creatures.
Yeah.
You know, with the beavers and all, and the fauns, and it was all very magical in a way, besides obviously the terrible things that the White Witch should have committed, and But yeah, I mean, like, at the end of that story, I was very sad to see them all go back to England because they all seemed to be having such a lovely time chasing white stags and bits and pieces. But Harry Potter as well, I mean, the magic. I got lost in that series when I was younger. Pun intended, magical stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard. I read the first one when I was about 9. It's very hard not to read that book and then not hope that an owl brings you a letter on your 11th birthday.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was my answer, yeah. Was Harry Potter. Straight up, like, that's, yeah. Because, I mean, like, you're a fucking wizard, man. Like, yeah. That would be amazing. It would be...
Hogwarts is huge. There's so many secrets, so much, like, to learn.
And I always wanted to go to boarding school when I was a kid.
That's weird.
I wanted to... I was that kid who was like, I want to get away from my family. I'd love to go to boarding school. Because then you have all this, like, you know, and it's very structured and you have, like, quality school.
But what if you get bullied?
That happens at regular school. It didn't fucking
matter. Yeah, but at least your mum and dad are there to, like, go beat them up for you.
That never happens. When is get the parents involved, the solution to any bully story?
So you've never seen someone getting bullied and then their dad walks in and smacks the kid on the floor?
No, I mean, if you're lucky, you might have an elder brother who'll deck him for you, but that's...
Which, in your case, you did.
Yeah, he was useless. Yeah, three. You seen my... Rob, yeah, but he was 9 years older, so, like, no, he was never in the same school. But Joe, nice guy, but, like, yeah, he's not a fighter. I mean, he does MMA now, but he's not a fighter.
But at that age, he's 3 years older than you?
Yeah.
That gives you a big enough advantage. I mean, I'm not condoning physical violence in school, but it makes you wonder. Because when you're detached like that, alone... You're really all left in your own devices, and that can be liberating, a kind of a survival instinct sort of might set in if there is any troubles. If there's no troubles, that's great. Or it can be very sort of damning if you don't have the strength to kind of fight through it.
Yeah, I mean, when I went to high school in England, like, high school in England's grade 7 to 13.
That's a terrible idea.
Well, it is a bit in a sense, but it wasn't like I got a lot of crap from, like, much older kids. It was always just the kids a year older or the same year. So I wouldn't even, you know, I wouldn't say that was actually a big problem. But the first year or two were sort of rough, but by, like, third year, you've made your friends and you know to stay away from, and you know in a pack you're sort of safe.
Yeah.
So I think even in boarding school you just have to not isolate yourself too much, and yeah, I mean, but the thing is, I went to a bunch of schools as a kid because we moved around, so, like, I was okay at making friends in a new school. It wasn't a big deal. But anyway, I was going to get back to one thing you said, which is you talked about, interestingly, the religious aspects of Chronicles of Narnia.
C.S. Lewis is
And it's funny because a lot of people, that's one thing I've heard people complain about who are Christian with Harry Potter, is that it's anti-religious or it's anti-Christian. But it's not.
Not really.
If you read it, the concept of heaven is very clearly stated in it, or at least some sort of afterlife of...
Alluded to, for sure,
Of, you know, serene sort of happiness.
Yeah.
Like, there's a definite claim of that. And then there's also just the fact that, like, there's this idea of good and evil and of
very sort of binary kind of theme.
I mean, it's not totally binary because that's why she throws in someone like Umbridge, who is,
like,
arguably...
Wasn't she the definition of pure evil?
Right, but she's not a Death Eater.
At least Voldemort had, like, an idea.
Yeah, but just the fact that the Death Eaters were seen as evil, but it wasn't, like, just the Death Eaters were evil. There was people who otherwise seemed normal who were equally terrible.
She was essentially a Death Eater.
she had a lot of the same ideas. Yeah,
yeah,
it's true.
Fascist, pink, Death Eater.
But yeah, so we could. So there we go. So there's definitely this good and evil sense to it, and there's. Yeah, no, I don't know. I think it's very, I don't know. It's very interesting. I mean, there's so much anthropology in it too, with the, like, sort of the battle of the rights of, like, non-wizards and
Muggles.
Sort of, well, no, but I'm thinking more like elfish welfare.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And also the goblins and things like that.
Trolls
and
make appearances.
Even giants. You know, it's a lot about sort of relations between different races of people or animals and. Well, you know, anything that has human sort of sense. It's very interesting because you could even throw it in speciesism as well and argue that as well about hurting animals and sentient beings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially when, like, he could talk to snakes, so that then says that, she's arguing that other animals have sentient thoughts. So, that's what I love about it, is there's so much in there.
But can't you deconstruct Harry Potter and reveal some very overt phallic themes?
Go ahead, if you want. I don't.
Wands. With
shit
coming out of them. Well, no, okay. Like, I don't believe that, but you have someone who will, you know, it's written by a woman. J.K. Rowling is obviously a woman, and has some strong female characters. Hermione being
Is the smartest person in the book. Yeah.
But like, I mean, you got a thing, Professor McGonagall. phallic objects stuff come out of them.
Get out.
Like, what is it? It's a big circle joke, apparently.
No, it's just based on mythological lore of wizardry.
Which was
wizardry.
Based in phallic reinforcing symbolism.
I think you're looking for the cocks in that one.
No, I am. But someone else has surely done that. And you're going to go like, seriously?
Yeah. No, there's so much counter-evidence that I will, you know. If the rest of the book was just about people touching their wands and stroking them and thinking about it a lot.
You've got a big piece of wood there.
Oh, you know he's a good wizard because that's a large wand in his
hand.
That's
a 12-incher.
Yeah, so, I don't think we have to worry about the phallic importance of... Yeah, I mean, but that's what, another great thing about Harry Potter is, like, you know, every character's name has some sort of, like...
phallic reference. You're such a big Neville.
With his long bottom. let's move on to our next question, because all the value in that discussion has disappeared very quickly. All right, so the next one is, does social network activism, you know, things like what Russell Brand and Ricky Gervais and a lot of famous and lots of non-famous people do as well, where they're trying to share information about atrocities and about uprisings and what's going on in the world, and they're sharing it, is that useful? Is it valuable? Does it serve a purpose? Is it something we should promote? Or is it arguably... just, you know, it's a lot of talk and not a lot to do, you know.
It's all slacktivism, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, that's one word that's been used about it. But, you know, it's like talk is cheap sort of thing. What do you think?
I think, I mean, in the end, there is merit in it. I think as a way of informing people, it's effective. I think that there are risks associated with that, like oversaturation and desensitization. Because if you have, like, 20 people share the same thing, or, like, the same three articles or whatever that are about this new atrocity that's been uncovered or that's just happened,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you read the first one, you go, it's terrible. And you read the second one, you go, it's terrible. It's just a rehash of the first one. Then read the third one, and then you get in two sentences, you know, okay, another story. And then they come back, and then people keep talking about them over the weeks. It's good that you know about it. It's good that you're aware of what's happening in the world. And knowledge is power. Upon knowledge, you can act. But a lot of people won't.
And a lot of it, like, you know, I think there's a difference between learning about something that's going on in your country, like, you know, the way that they spread the information during the Arabic Spring. Like things like that obviously are important. But, like, if you know, using the example of the lion killing. I mean, I guess arguably because he was from a Western country, there's something to be said for raising sort of the alarm about people going to poach animals who are from countries that are, you know. But if, like, you're sharing this information with a bunch of people, you know, maybe a better example would be something like, you know, talking about Boko Haram. You know, it's going on in a country that is a sovereign country, and we are here in Canada where... we don't have the right to intervene, arguably, in sovereign nations. And, you know, it's pretty, you know, that's getting into world police territory, and there's all sorts of complications, and invading countries is time and time again proved fruitless and destabilizing. So, you know, it's not difficult to say we don't have a right to go in there and do anything about it. So then, you know, we're spreading the information, but we're arguably spreading it to the wrong people. Like, unless we're connecting with people on the ground who are in those countries or are going to be affected by it, then it's like pissing in the wind. We're not doing ourselves any favors, and that, you know, it's going on useless ears. I wouldn't say deaf ears. I would say useless ears, because, you know, you're telling your friends, that's great, you all know, but it's not helping women being, you know, annihilated. You know, really the UN are the people that need to talk about it. And trust me, like, the UN does monitor a lot of this stuff within these countries, and there are people, you know, that's what they do. So they're probably going to know about it before we tweet about it in Canada. So yeah, I just feel like you should be doing things that are charitable and you should be doing things that are selfless and are, but closer to, start closer to home. Spread information to people who can do something with it. So talk about issues in Canada, if you're in Canada, and try and push people to do something about them here, if you feel strongly about them. And do take notice of these things, but really beyond instructing people, sending information and tweeting the UN and being like, oh, I do something about this. Issues that are outside of our domain, I don't know how much point there is to us, constantly talking about them. It's a tough one. Heartless. I know it sounds heartless, but I'm trying to be
practical about these things. Because we all have limited amounts of prioritization and time, and we can definitely stretch what we mean. I think plenty of people could do a lot more than they do. But at the same time, I think you're right. I think it's probably better in the long run to take care of your own sort of backyard, your home, to make sure that's all in order, than to try and mess around in the business of others. However well-intentioned, there are organizations, and some would criticize them for not being effective, and sometimes they have a very fair point. But that doesn't necessarily mean that, like the whole Kony 2012 thing. Like, so that was perhaps one of the first really big viral online activist movement. What happened?
Yeah, because
a lot of people donated money, and I haven't heard about it since.
And with that one, and I think that's a great example of it, which was people made a big aggro, got upset about it. And they didn't really understand the nuances of the situation on the ground.
Not at all.
And that's what I'm talking about. Like, us trying to process this information without any reference point here, it's very tough to do it effectively and if you're getting information from Western sources, they have a Western bias on it. So
it's not even necessarily a Western bias, I would argue. But I'd just argue that any attempt to spread that information for people who aren't writing in their own experience, in their own vernacular, any representation is a simplification, which in its essence means it's not 100% correct. And it's very likely incorrect or unnuanced, which means not necessarily that it's Western, but it's just not them. The Chinese source could do the same if it's an African problem with nuances that have been contextualized within that area. Like, only someone who's living in there can really give the best representation. But if they're not doing it, if they're not being allowed to through censorship, or they don't have the ability to go viral, is it worth someone else, Western media or activists, is it worth them trying to do their best, even if they're not actually representing the situation to its closest accuracy?
Yeah, and that's why I say perhaps alerting to some more qualified sources such as the UN or NGOs that are set up in those countries to help. There is obviously some validity in that, but I think that there's a limitation to that people aren't seeing. The problem is that it does become a lot more difficult in that every situation is different, every issue is different, and maybe there are some issues that there is something that can be done or should be done. But again, it's very hard. I'm not a cultural relativist, but I think I am a sovereignist. And I think that if until the majority of that country decides that there's a problem, then we have no right to say there's a problem. If that society is not functioning, then there's a problem. But then and change comes from within. Then, but it's very hard to stand on the outside and dictate what should happen in any other country.
Yeah.
It's dangerous, dangerous precedents, and it has not gone well for anyone, any European country or any American country when they have tried to do this in the past. And we, for once, need to learn from history and not repeat ourselves.
So I think there's also, in working with NGOs and working, because the Kony people, was it called the Invisible Children? Was it the NGO that they professed to be helping the children on the ground in Nigeria, the former child soldiers, in the Central African Republic or Congo? But when you spread information, like if we take the example we sort of applied in the sketch, the example of Cecil the Lion, a lot of activism went on about that. Particularly Ricky Gervais was very vocal online. He's a big animal rights activist. I'm sure with his help, they raised a lot. Not they, but animal rights groups, especially in that region, raised a lot of money through donations to go towards enforcing and being able to enforce protection of the wildlife areas. Be able to platform to lobby to buy out poachers or something like that. I'm sure they got some good resources to combat these things, but money isn't always the best way to do things.
And I mean, look at the tsunami disaster in 2005 in Indonesia.
It was right at the end. It was like 2020 November, December 27th, something like that. Yeah.
And in that scenario, we sent billions of dollars, and because they didn't have unscrupulous governments in charge of some areas, we ended up with all this aid just disappearing into, you know, and this is why we have famines in Africa. It's not because food doesn't get sent there. It's because the governments that are operating in these countries are not stable and do not distribute the aid properly, because the people that provide the aid don't have the right to just go in there and distribute it if the government says no. So then they hand it over
to the government
who then uses
other subsidiaries,
who then use it to basically fuel the civil war or whatever other reason.
Or just keep
the famine is being caused.
Keep to apply the oppression.
That happens all the time in countries like the Congo and Somalia,
Sudan,
and Sudan, these places where you see the famine. So yeah, like throwing money at it isn't the answer necessarily. I mean, I think maybe with the lion situation, that might be one situation where if we can stop people going from countries outside of the country where the lions are, that if we can stop people going in there to poach. But it's hard, because how do you separate a tourist from a hunting tourist?
Well, presumably they have a gun.
But I'm sure they have guns there. You know, I'm sure you could rep one pretty easy. So it's, and a lot of the time, someone will go out and kill them for them, or like basically drag them there and make it easy for them.
But another question I have is, so you spread this word virally, and so there's this atrocity, this activist movement, it now becomes viral. It's on Facebook, Twitter, everywhere. There's a lot of people talking about it, not necessarily doing a lot. But surely there's always going to be a couple people, not necessarily a lot, a couple people, though, who understand it. And it really does make a big difference in their lives. And they go out of the way to maybe apply to be a part of NGOs or to start their own organizations. Yeah. So there's always, presumably, this internet activism will inspire some people to action. I have no doubt about that. But is it worth those, I don't know, 0.2% people who take part in it? Is it worth them being able to be inspired to take part in these organizations if the information that's circling is desensitizing the masses, is perhaps incorrect, or as we said earlier, not contextually appropriate? Is it worth it in the end, you think?
I think maybe it is, because I actually have a great example of that, which is a friend of my mum's in England. Her brother was watching TV during the Kosovo war in the 90s, and he was and I think it was Romania, there was a lot of conflict too, and was completely blown away by some of the state he saw of children facilities there. So he got this idea. He was a long haul trucker, so he and a bunch of other long haul truckers basically got together and just got supplies, got blankets and food and medicine and all these things. And got I think they had 6 or 7, 8 trucks in their convoy, and then just drove from England, or Wrexham rather, in Wales, all the way to Eastern Europe. And apparently, the first time they did it, they literally had to give their clothes off their back at some different border stops just to get through, your watch, and you literally had to bribe every border guard. And they got through, and they gave it, and they got there and went, this is not enough, we need to do something. So then my mum's friend came up with the shoebox idea, which you might have heard of, which is Operation Christmas Child. And they started Operation Christmas Child in Wrexham there. And it's that thing kids do every year in a lot of schools in Europe and in America, where you put toys and chocolate and things in a shoebox, and then you wrap it in Christmas paper. And then they literally send these thousands and millions of boxes now, I think it is, every year, to places like that who need Just to make them smile, just to make them and there's videos of it. It's so sweet where they they go to these orphanages where these kids are living, in their own filth, and there's one care worker for 10 kids, and some of them have basically had no attention for years, and you give them toys. They've never had a toy before. They've never tasted chocolate. They've never had someone give something to them and say, "This is yours," and it's amazing to watch. And yeah, that was all because he watched the news one night and said, "I've got to do something." So it can happen, and it does happen, and the effects, and now, as I say, they do millions of these boxes a year. He got knighted for it.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so, I think I'm coming around to your side that if we can just inspire a few people to do it, I think it's worth it. I think it is. All right, let's play a song, and we'll come back. This is, we're going to play Ray Spoon with Winter Across.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here,
God, Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Ugh. Everybody, God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Isn't there anything, 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 anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
There you go, that was Rocker Code with Hunter Gatherer.
fun band, Rocker Code.
Yeah, man, that whole album is pretty good.
It's just kind of funky, poppy, kind of groovy.
Yeah, it's every electro pop. Yeah. Throw that in. Yeah, it's good. All right, let's carry on though with the chit chat. So our next topic of conversation for tonight, sir, is we had that one sketch where the guy goes into Lush. So I'm wondering off the back of that is...
Lush actually sell fudge brownies?
By the way, listeners, the whole fudge reference is because I remember being a kid and walking past Lush for the first time and generally thought it was a fudge shop for the first... And then I'm like, yeah, it wasn't.
You wouldn't be the only one.
Disappointed. Because they were huge blocks of fudge. I was like, hell yeah, going in there. but anyway, is the cosmetics industry immoral? Because I think there could be a good case to be made for it.
Are you talking about immoral because they often let me lay out
the possibilities. Right. Okay. So yes, obviously one good argument is the testing of products on animals. Another is the idea that it's an entire industry built on the idea of making people feel inadequate, in that you're selling a product which you're telling them that they need to look pretty. And it's a very unfair thing, because what you've done then is you've moved the expectation of what people should look like, and then if people are susceptible to it and are insecure or want to make them feel confident, whatever the reason is, they then are sort of pushed into feeling like they have to keep up, they have to do it, and the same could be said. Well, it's kind of funny because there's an industry that's illegal on the male sort of counter to that, which is the same thing, which is steroids, which is, part of the problem with steroids is if a load of men start taking steroids, then other men feel insecure and then feel like they need to be big.
And their penises get smaller by ratio.
because there is bigorexia, and in men is more of an issue. And more, at least a more apparent issue, where there's lots of people suffering from it, where, they feel insecure because they're never big enough and they never look powerful enough, and then take, dangerous steroids to get to that place. And we obviously see that as immoral. And also there's the health effects and things like that. I guess if they didn't have health effects, they probably would be legal. Because creatine's legal, and that's sort of along those lines. But creatine's still sort of bad for your liver, I think, and a few other things. But yeah, are cosmetics sort of setting people up to basically make them feel like they have to buy their products because otherwise they're ugly, which is not fair. I mean, you could argue perhaps that there's lots of girls, I think I'm sure you've seen, and you never really thought, oh, she needs more makeup. That's not really something I think that goes through guys' heads.
Never thought of that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like theatre. I don't know what the possibilities could have been. I all I see is the final product. So I'm not going, oh, well, yeah, a bit more eyeshadow there would have made things a bit more sexy. I don't see things like that. All I see is what's there to see. And then, I don't really tend to judge people, but, sometimes you go, oh, that person is quite pretty, or that person, oh, not quite my style, my type, whatever. Criticizing and demolishing their aesthetic, because beauty is different from every person.
Yeah, and some people go, oh, but if you saw her without makeup, then you wouldn't think she's pretty. And
I don't know, I'd be
I'm not saying specific. Just saying, you hear that sort of that thought, and yeah, and he's sort of like, but if I always thought she'd look like that, maybe that I would think she was pretty, but only because I have this weird heightened expectation of her appearance that I then, in contrast, can't, find it a little...
See, that's the thing that I have a bit of an issue with. It's like, so if you wear makeup quite often, and I get it if it's just a little bit of this or that, but people wear...
Yeah, because I think it's the difference between bit of eyeshadow to bring out your eyes versus wearing a different shade of skin tone.
Yeah.
And then covering up every imperfection. Which is interesting, because cosmetics can clog your pores and can give you bad skin, and they can make your it can make it a lot worse.
But by doing that, I mean, I guess you could get in some kind of identity politics in a way, in you should be able to choose what you look like in some ways, or how to augment or improve how you look. But to me, it just seems a bit of a farce almost. Like if you're doing it every now and again for a nice event or whatever, once a week or whatever, no worries. I get it. You want to go out, you want to look good, sure.
Yeah.
But if you're doing it every day, people spend 40 minutes every day doing
their
makeup.
Yeah, I've dated girls that take hours to get ready, and it's all the makeup. It's not showering and other things. It's it's an hour of makeup preparation.
And I just feel you're living in this.
Living a lie.
Essentially. Yeah, I mean, because I mean, if I was to be that person's partner, you'd probably know, because at the end of the evening, they'd wash their face and then you'd see them. And hopefully you'd be accepting. But anyone else who sees that and then suddenly it's like, it's kind of weird. It's unnerving. It's like, have you been trying to... It doesn't need to be personal, but anyone who's known you for a while and then suddenly sees you without all this makeup you've been wearing, what are you meant to think?
Yeah. It's very, like, even psychologically, it's a very strange thing, and that... Yeah, like, I don't know. It's hard as well to talk about these sort of things because this is arguably a female issue and the men aren't under the same pressure. I mean, there are still men that wear
sexist.
Makeup.
Men can wear makeup.
They can. I mean, I wear
you wear black
paint.
Nails.
I wear black nail paint every day. Most of the time it's very
hey, Simon,
chipped.
Are you a metalhead?
Someone on the train asked me that last night. That was a fun conversation. I'm not saying they can't, but I'm just saying that, like, in general, there isn't the same pressure there. That's again, a total choice for men whether they do it or not. But for women, there is an expectation.
It's an obligation
there.
Almost.
It's in the same way that they're pressured to have a certain body type. It's all in that same sort of ballpark of, like, you know, women, these are the expectations of your gender. And there are the same pressures on men, and that goes back to the bigorexia thing. And, men, feeling like there's this idea of masculinity that they have to, you know, live up to, otherwise they're not real men or whatever, which is bollocks. It's complete rubbish. And again, like, that sort of has roots, and you see that, and like, it's manipulated in advertising, but advertising will always do that because it'll always push the boundaries of good taste and you know, acceptability to sell products, I think banning products and banning what you can advertise and things like that is, you know, unless it's killing people, it's very, you know, it's a slippery slope to start banning sort of different products and things. Because, yeah, people should be allowed to do it, but I think the mentality of the public is what would have to change and what can change, in the same way that it has for a lot of other things, in things like smoking. I'm trying to think of other good examples, like CFC gases or, what's the cause of
asbestos.
Asbestos, great example there. So, but again, that's something that was hurting people. So yeah, that's a no-brainer. But yeah, like, I just think that, and there is sort of a movement of the, like, no makeup hashtag, isn't there? And there's been, again, some hacktivism. Some hacktivism. I think it's more of an Instagram thing. Or a Pinterest sort of.
But here's my question as well. So, I get the impression that in this debate, there are kind of two ways of looking at it. This is an impression, is that either you should be, as an individual who pursues their own individual desires, you should not be judged, or you should not be, or you should not feel bad for wanting to wear lots of makeup on a consistent basis. And you kind of get that. I mean, each to their own. Like, do what you want, do what makes you happy. But on the other hand, there's also this movement of, like, hey, you should be able to accept who you are, how you look, and rock that. And it's not everyone's cup of tea, whatever, fuck them. Like, be happy in your own skin kind of thing. So do you see those two as conflicting? Do you see those as different movements stemming from the same sort of point?
Because that's the thing. Like, I mean, it's not like, you have to wear makeup for a couple of years and then at 28, suddenly you're gorgeous and then you'll be gorgeous forever. Like, it's a slow decline from... 27, 28 for most people, maybe even a little younger, depending on, how you develop.
Stuff,
In a way, it's like, it's probably healthier to embrace the decline as it comes. But people don't. I mean, people have plastic surgery. But then again, that's a cultural thing in that there are more vain sort of cultures. And that, like, I know friends who've moved to LA and they've said, they do... It seems like it's more common for people to have plastic surgery and to be very careful at making sure they look perfect,
immaculate
every time they go out. And it's funny because there's even more of that in at least the subculture of it in Britain. In that, I knew, you go out for dinner, a lot of people wouldn't go out in jeans. They would have to put on trousers, and women would have to look nice. And casual dining is probably getting more common now, but it was very, still a bit stiff, really, going out for dinners and things like that. And yeah, so, you know, I mean, that's interesting about Canada and a lot of North America. It's very casual.
Yeah.
It is very casual. And that's not a bad thing. Like, I mean, I don't dress up particularly Never. Often, so not a big deal. But yeah, I don't know, man. I don't know what this, like, it, this, I think you're right. Maybe the, like, be happy with who you are sort of thing. But then, like, the people are like, will worry, well, if you talk about that with things like obesity, then you're, you know, arguably making the problem worse in terms of the...
Well, but I mean, but there is... I mean, if you think about obesity, there are things... I mean, not every... Sometimes, you know, glandular issues, hormonal issues. Sometimes, yeah, insecurity, stress can feed obesity. Yeah. So, not that... But you can change it still. So there are things that might aid you in getting to that stage which is unhealthy. But you can change with your appearance. Without plastic surgery or makeup, there's not a lot you can do besides maybe gaining or losing weight that can really alter your fundamental appearance.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you know, I know there is glandular problems, but they are rare.
They're not the most common,
because you just have to look at, well, where were all these glandular problems 100 years ago if that many people had them?
Yeah, or why are they all in the United States?
Yeah, like, clearly there are some people who have that, but for the majority, it's lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it makes total sense. American culture, a lot of places, unless you're in New York, even in, like, other major cities like LA, everybody drives everywhere because everywhere's too far apart. You can't walk anywhere. There's no downtown city core, really, like there is in Vancouver, even. Yeah. So you drive, and, you know, meals, portions are larger, more saturated fat.
Fast food joints.
I lived
on the way.
In Florida. It was very hard to buy healthy, you know, healthy food was expensive.
Which is reasonably sized portions, yeah.
It was expensive.
And you feel bad if you throw stuff away, I've not finished
it. Yeah, I paid like $8 for a bit of red pepper hummus at the freaking supermarket. Like, yeah. It was stupid. But, so yeah, like, clearly that is a lifestyle thing. And yeah, I think if there's one thing people should change to make themselves feel better, if that's something they're concerned about, it's definitely losing weight, because it gives you more energy, it, you know, helps your mood, and you can't help but feel a bit better if your clothes are a little less tight, and, you know, even it doesn't even have to be much, but, like,
just feel comfortable in your clothes.
Yeah, even things like, you know, if your digestion's better, you'll feel better. Like, if you're eating better food, like, you know, eating
just
McDonald's.
Less stress if you're worried about it, you're feeling insecure about it.
Yeah, totally. So, yeah. Like, you know, if you want to change something, like, that's a healthy thing to change, but, yeah, makeup, like, it's maybe a bit of a fallacy, too.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think... you know, people are quite discernible and can see beyond the makeup, so to speak, a lot of the time. So, you know, you might only just be kidding yourself in some sense. That's harsh, but it's, you know, what we're saying is be happy with who you are, embrace who you are, and own it.
You're the only you, and, like, no one else can do you, so yeah, rock it. I do have one other thing to say about the... Because I think we've almost slightly gone off the topic of immorality or ethics in regards to this industry, and I wonder... Don't a lot of other industries, most industries maybe, play on insecurity? Isn't that the point of, like, hey, you have a new iPhone, it's bigger, it's better, it's faster, well, yours is insignificant and bad, and you should buy this because it'll make you better. Aren't a lot of things kind of based on that kind of, you don't have good enough, or?
Well, I've worked in sales a lot before I, like, went to uni, and two areas that people look at when you're trying to sell people stuff is... that are linked to insecurity is lifestyle, which is you sell the product by saying that, you know, you are a modern man and you want to be with the latest trends, and that's your lifestyle. You have the latest fashion, the latest trends, you like new music, you like to keep up with things. So this phone, if I'm selling you a phone, fits into your lifestyle. So that's one way you do it. And then the other way is, you know, the arguing for, like, sort of, value as well, in that, like, it'll make your life better, literally. Yeah. And those are, like, the kind of elements that you see in any sort of insecurity thing, which is, like, you know, you want to, if you're not living this life, then you're not living, and mm-hmm. you know, you being passed by and blah 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 and all that. So yeah, that definitely sales and insecurity go together. And this is why, like, I never want to work in advertising or marketing, because I think the whole thing is, like, I mean, the amount of money companies spend on that, like, you know, like, it could be 20-25% of your budget when it comes to producing a product, you know, above and beyond what you're spending to actually manufacture the product. And it's just wasted money.
Yeah.
You know, it creates jobs, I guess, but
It's funny to think, where's the money go to? It goes to like poster agencies.
Well, the funny thing is though, is like
commercial shooters.
Yeah,
and, yeah.
But the funny thing is, in a sense, is that that's a messed up thing. When you make a commercial, like you go to a advertising company and you say, I want to spend $500,000 on this commercial. Then they'll cut that in half and take $250,000 and then give $250,000 to the production company that's doing it. And so by the time you actually get down to what's being spent on the actual commercial, it's not
500 yeah. grand,
but they want a 500 grand commercial. And then this is where people down the bottom get chat on, like the, you know, people who set up the set, and that's what they cut corners there, or, you know, in the people's wages at the bottom. But yeah, there's plenty of money being made off top. But funny enough, we have to, you know, without advertising, you don't have commercial television.
Yeah.
And
well,
so,
at least as we've known it, yeah.
I mean, most commercial TV is pretty bad, but a lot of it in America, that's basically all they have. So it produces all the content that we like. You know, the only things that are outside of that are HBO, PBS, CBC in Canada. Obviously, the BBC in Britain is a fantastic non-commercial product. And like the Australian Film Board does lots of great work, which is not using commercial money. But yeah, so it's like we could do without it, but it does do some good. But that's not to say you can't advertise other good products. Like you could still advertise things people need.
Advertise in a way that's positive and enforcing rather than playing on insecurity.
Yeah, and make money, innovate products that people actually need rather than just trying to sell them stuff you think will make them make them feel slightly better when in reality
your football boots just aren't fast enough. Yeah. Nike Predator X669.
Then you'll play like Beckham. Yeah. Yeah, that's all you needed was a new pair of boots.
How can you be Messi until you buy Adidas?
Exactly. All right, we're going to play we'll play one more song, come back, do a little more chat, and then play our final song as we say goodbye. So next up, we're going to play You Say Party with Ignorance. We'll be right back. All right, there you go. That was You Say Party with Ignorance. All right, this is the White Noise After Show. My name is Simon Welton, and I'm still joined in the studio by Connor Neckleput.
I'm still here.
Yeah, he certainly is. All right, so we've got one last quick topic before we leave tonight, which is we brought up in one sketch. We didn't really bring it up, but it was sort of flirted on, was the idea of drinking ages, as we discussed buying booze for underage kids. That was just an absurdist sketch. I wasn't trying to make a point about letting 14-year-olds drink. That
it
was
really sounded like you thought I went to buy drinks for 14-year-old girls. I thought, actually, which is a bit inappropriate, so I'm glad you've clarified that.
Well, I just wanted to hear you say that on the radio so I could then blackmail you with it later. But
or blackmail me with it.
Nice. But so my question though related to that is there a good drinking age, you know, that there should be across the board? Because you see everything from 16 with dinner in certain European countries, including Britain, to 18 in a lot of countries and provinces, and then 19 only in BC. I don't know. I think maybe Ontario or a few other places, and then 21. In America. So obviously, you know, that's a big disparity. That's five, you know, we're talking 5 years of difference. So is there a true drinking age?
Well, I guess there's two things at play when it comes to drinking age that I can think of. One is anatomical and cranial development. The way your brain develops can be retarded and slowed by drinking at early ages. I think it's not until you're about 25 years old that, and roughly, that your brain has more or less stopped developing. And the other thing, I guess, is just responsibility and maturation of you as a person, within your identity. I think those are the two topics that are most closely entwined in restrictions on drinking and attempts to prohibit young people from being able to drink. Mm. And on the first one, it's difficult to know how much, you know, all you see is what you end up with. So it's difficult to know that by drinking at a young age, how much more developed your brain could have been and what that really means for your behavior and the way that you continue your life. You might end up being and seeming totally normal. And then you might be like, well, nothing went wrong. So it's impossible to know, which is on one hand a bit kind of worrying, but on the other hand, it doesn't leave you with a sense of, oh, I'm losing something. So I think there's a responsibility which sort of escapes there. And on the sort of side of the person, and the maturation and getting to know the world and not making mistakes, I think, yeah, it's difficult to know because everyone matures at a different pace. Everyone has different experiences.
Which is why you try and create a general idea. I mean, what I think would be a good in-between and would be a sort of sensible way of doing it is to say that the legal drinking age for wine and beer can be 18. Yeah. And cider could be 18. But I don't think selling spirits to people under 21 is really a good idea because it's very hard to get alcohol poisoning off beer and wine.
You have to drink a lot of it.
You have to, you know, you throw up and you get the spins and you get very hungover. But I've never heard of a friend going to hospital from drinking beer, but you'd sugar 2 6 of vodka and surprise, surprise, you'd like, you know, black out and you end up in A&E. Needing a stomach pump. So, you know, I think that, you know, the strength of alcohol is something that is not a bad idea to sort of try and balance. And you know, obviously this should be done from parents in an ideal situation. And, you know, like the one thing that blew my mind when I moved to Canada, I was living in Kelowna, and one thing that a lot of kids did there, you know, drinking under 19, was you had bush parties. We'd all drive up to the middle of nowhere where there's a bonfire near a lake maybe or something with all your cars and then get hammered in, you know, nowhere near any help. And no shit, people got hurt. People walked off fucking cliffs, you know, like all sorts of damage. People fell in fires. Some horrible things happened. actual sexual assaults or borderline sexual assaults, because there's no supervision. And there's nothing wrong with someone 17 or 18 exploring alcohol. You know, in a lot of cultures, that's pretty normal. But have some parent there to drive them, at least drive them to the hospital if they get sick, or to, you know, help them if they become too inebriated to look after themselves. Like, that, you know, there's nothing wrong with supervising adolescents. So, like, and when you're, you know, mixing it with something particularly dangerous, that's when they need the most supervision.
Yeah, no, I think you raise a good point in allowing kids and teenagers and young adults to, I don't want to say experiment because I'm not sure that's the right word, but to be able to begin to form these experiences in a secure environment, in a supportive environment, is important.
Yeah.
Exactly for the reasons that you've outlined. I've actually never thought of it quite like that, but that's actually a fantastic point. If you make it so stigmatized and you prohibit it, naturally people will do it. And if that means going out to the middle of nowhere without, yes, any sort of regular supervision, that is actually very dangerous, far more dangerous than if the kids are drinking down the pub. Or in your house, yeah. if you're there, or if your older sister or older brothers are there, or something like that. So I think you actually raise a great point, and I've never thought about the alcohol, the power of alcohol being something to perhaps break apart. But I also think you make an excellent point. Yeah, how many people have got have gone to hospital from getting from plastered off beer. Yeah, I don't know anyone that's happened to.
But, you know, and especially with things like shots, because, like, you could do, like, if you do, like, a half vodka, half orange juice. I mean, we shouldn't be telling people this, but if you do half vodka, half orange juice, it basically just tastes like orange juice, and you could knock those back one after another, and you could get really messed up. Because think about it, you're drinking the same alcohol that's in a beer in 2 seconds rather than 30 minutes.
And there's only that much liquid in it as well. Like,
you're dehydrating yourself. It's just, you're asking for trouble with spirits. Like, they are pretty dangerous. And, you know, they really came about because of prohibition. They became popular in the States during prohibition because you could, rum, they basically would sneak in and, you know, you just needed to, like, a whole barrel of it could feed an entire pub rather than, like, you know, trying to get in 10 caskets of beer.
Yeah.
It's a bit like, would dabs be a thing if marijuana wasn't prohibited, if people weren't trying, or, you know, work out ways to concentrate it, mm-hmm. and then, you know, what if that has a connection to prohibition?
Yeah, because making it taboo actually only allows for a subculture to kind of develop around it, which in many ways goes for the bigger and better and more and stronger examples and additions, the right word, samples of those things, which, yeah, in many cases can be detrimental to your health or actually harmful in the short term. And so it's best not to make those things so stigmatized, but to allow people to, I don't want to say make mistakes, but to learn with supervision, to learn with support around them, so that if something does go wrong, that there's someone there that they can rely upon. My question to you in that regard is, do you think it's sensible, or else perhaps a reasonable idea, for parents to actually try and get their children sort of tipsy, maybe a bit drunk, when they're not really young, but 17, 18, if they haven't been doing it, just so that they begin to feel like what it's like and get an idea of the tolerance?
Well, that's probably the best way to make it uncool is to be like,
yeah.
And that's what I was going to say.
Tommy, drink this beer now.
Last thing I was going to say was that, you know, I think one reason that I don't drink a lot, really, I drink socially, I drink with friends, and my family's here, I drink a lot. But if I'm on my own, I don't have much inclination to go get beer. And I think that's because I've been exposed to it for a long time, and it was never that exciting, even in 2021. Like, I go drink with my mates on a Saturday, I never anywhere near thinking, you know, anywhere near what you would call alcoholism or any sort of addiction to it or obsession with it. There was never that. I could, you know, could go without it any day of the week. I think simple exposure to it and the sort of, you know, removing any sort of excitement around it is not a bad thing with any form of drug.
Make beer boring.
Yeah. You know, but it's true. Like, you know, if chocolate and sweet adverts weren't so exciting, less people, you know, like if there, you know, if it wasn't like, you know, and it's the thing, like if it becomes this reliever from stress and it feels like an out because it's a release of some sort, this is where the addiction comes from, this routine of release from, you know, from your problems through whatever it is, whether it's sugar or caffeine or cigarettes or alcohol or weed or porn or whatever it is. It's, yeah.
Running. With,
it, when there's no taboo, it does get rid of a lot of psychological desire.
Yeah.
It's interesting. All right, I think we should leave it there.
I think we've exhausted our time limit for today.
Yeah.
Today and tomorrow.
The last track we're going to leave you with tonight is from Milktoast, and it's called Dave is Like a Fine Wine. We will be back next week, hopefully. I don't see any reason why not.
That's the plan.
Unless something goes horribly wrong. Let's hope not.
Richard Blackmore gets married.
That's not likely. Not likely at all, sir. Thank you very much, Connor, for being here this
thanks
week.
Thanks for having me again, Simon. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Always a pleasure to have you here. And hopefully we'll be back with a few more co-stars next week for our show. So it's not just me and
at least
Connor.
The,
our vocal range is impressive, but... I think eventually we're going to push it too far. So
this is just going to get racist.
yeah. Okay. Well, as long as it's European racism, no one minds.
Oh, no one minds,
Because we're white, so we can be racist to other Europeans, and no one seems to find it offensive for
some
reason.
Crack a racism, man. Like, go for it.
But I like to think, hopefully our listeners have noticed that we're pretty good at, like, we don't go too... cheap, like with stereotypes or anything like that. Like, that's not our bag. We're above that nonsense, I hope.
We're full of nonsense, but we're above that nonsense.
On that, like, friggin' highfalutin smart, just rub
pretentious as...
just slap ourselves on the back there. Yeah. Alright, this is Milktoast.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen.
Have a lovely night.
But